Mr. Holmes, room 1. Where were you born, please?
In Margate, Kent.
Which year was this?
In 1930.
What did your father do for a living?
He was the station fire officer in Hythe.
In Hampshire?
Yes.
Did you go to school in Hythe?
Yes, I did.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
So, when you left school, this was 1944.
That's correct.
Were you in any of the bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Well, peripherally, because Hythe, of course, didn't suffer from the Blitz. We saw the Blitz on Southampton, being only a mile away. But my most vivid recollection of the war is watching the attack on the Vickers Supermarine factory in Woolston, which we saw from this side of Southampton Water. And what was incredible about it was that the aircraft came up in complete stereotype formation, and not a gun fired at them from start to finish. They just went straight over the target, dropped their bombs, come round the top end of Southampton Water, and flew off back to France.
Could you see much in terms of flames or smoke?
Yes, the factory was well and truly hit, and the aircraft, when they came down our side of Southampton Water, were flying very low. You could actually see the airmen inside the aircraft. They couldn't have been more than 500 to 800 feet high.
How was it that you happened just to be watching at the time?
Well, I was a young boy, and I suppose I was going to high school at the time, because it was virtually at the start of the war, and I would have been out in the field just watching them.
Did you recognise them instantly as enemy planes?
No, I'm sure I can distinctly remember people standing around at the time saying, look at our aircraft over there, because at that time of the war, very seldom saw any aircraft. And we were all completely convinced that they were British, of course, because they were in such perfect formation. And absolutely horrified when we saw the bombs dropping from them.
Was it high level or dive bombing?
No, it was quite low level. I wouldn't have thought they were more than 1,000 feet high when they dropped the bombs. But they weren't dive bombing.
Did it have a bad effect on morale?
No, I don't think so. I think the reaction of most people, as far as I can remember as a young boy, was how typical. Everyone at that stage of the war, having just gone through the phony war, was, I think, fairly blasé and assuming that we were going to do badly to start with.
What date approximately would this have been?
As far as I can remember, it was early in 1941.
Any other air attacks that you witnessed?
Well, other than not to actually witness, the bombing of Southampton, of course, in 1941 during the Blitz was all nighttime raids. But certainly we saw the searchlights and the barrage balloons and the bombs falling and so on. And the dock end of Southampton was virtually destroyed in two main raids.
Did you go into Southampton to see the damage?
We used to have to go across every so often to do our more detailed shopping. The village only had small general stores at the time, and I can distinctly remember as a young boy walking up the high street where all these buildings had been devastated by the bombs, having to put a handkerchief over your face because of the smell of the bodies, which hadn't at that time been recovered. And I believe that on some occasions quicklime was put down because it was so difficult to get the bodies out as a means of stopping the spread of an epidemic.
Which parts of Southampton, which streets or buildings do you remember being hit?
Well, the lower end below Bar, between the Bar Gate and High's Ferry, which is the lower end of the High Street, virtually all of that was flattened at one stage.
Why don't you think they attacked High?
Well, we had two factories here. We had a British powerboat factory which made SE rescue craft and motor torpedo boats. And the Imperial Airways, which made Sunderland flying boats. But for some reason or other, they were never attacked right the way throughout the war. It was all the raids were concentrated on Portsmouth docks and on Southampton docks.
Do you think that the Blitz damaged morale in the city very much?
Very hard to say, living on the outskirts. I think, yes, during the period of the Blitz, I think people got very concerned on whether the country was strong enough to overcome the threat that was sort of poised on their doorstep. But I don't think that morale completely crumbled. I think that the general reaction after the first couple of raids was let's all work together and overcome the problems. But as I say, I was a very young boy at the time, so you get a rather false impression.
Was there much hatred of the German pilots who were carrying out the bombing, do you think?
Yes, oh, a great deal, I think. Yes. Yes, I know that. One's feeling at the time was certainly that our airmen were all good and theirs were all nasty beasts. But, of course, years afterwards, you can see that both sides were doing much the same thing towards the end.
Was there any question of you personally being evacuated?
No. A lot of children in Southampton were evacuated to the immediate countryside. In fact, a friend of mine was evacuated from the centre of Southampton to a little village in Hampshire in the New Forest. And during one of the raids, a German aircraft was hit by anti-aircraft fire and landed on his house and destroyed best part of the bedroom that he was living in. And of course, when his mother realised that he was no safer in the countryside than he would have been in Southampton, he was very quickly whisked back home again.
Why was there no question of your being evacuated?
Well, I just think that the majority of people in Hythe felt that we were far enough away from the docks not to be hit. And certainly, although there were the occasional bombs dropped on this side of the water, most of the damage, of course, fell in fields and in areas where there was no loss of life. The one claim to fame that our parish can have, I believe, is that our church, Dibden Church, was the first church in England to be destroyed by German bombing. And that was hit by incendiary bombs very early in the war. I think the impression most people locally had was that anything that happened on this side of the water would have simply been those German aircraft which had been unable to release their bombs when they were bombing Southampton, getting rid of their load when they came down our side of the water on their return flight home. And I suspect that's really what happened to Dibden Church. Although, of course, at the time there was a huge public outcry about these terrible people who destroy our religious buildings.
Were you ever frightened in the Second World War?
No, I was too young. It was all a big big game. I don't think we ever went into an air raid shelter at any time, and certainly my recollections of the Blitz is constantly being dragged away from the windows by my mother, because my brother and I would be at the windows looking out to see the searchlights and the flashes and the bangs in Southampton from our window.
Were there any particular games that you played connected with the war?
Oh, I think all children, of course, read avidly about the exploits of the commandos and the special troops and actions that were being taken. So, as far as I can remember, we were always playing soldiers and fighting each other, and the ones you didn't like were always the Germans.
Any collecting that you did that was connected with the Second World War?
Collecting, sorry.
Collecting things. I know some people collected shrapnel.
Indeed, yes. Yes, we did used to collect shrapnel. The only item I've got at the moment which was collected by my father during the Second World War is a compartment brass nameplate from an E-boat. Apparently this E-boat was captured by the Royal Navy and brought into the British Powerboat Company, where my father was a chief fire officer and where I eventually worked as a young apprentice towards the end of the war. And the E-boat was repaired and then manned by a Royal Naval crew and put back into service for the Royal Navy. And all of the brass nameplates for the various compartments and bits of equipment on board the craft, of course, were all written in German. And to avoid cost, the plates were taken off. The English description of what they were marking was inscribed on the reverse side of the plate, and then they were screwed back onto the same place with the inscription on the reverse. And I've got one of those in my garden, which is a piece of memorabilia of the time.
What about your food supply in the war? Did you suffer from lack of adequate food, or were you well fed?
I think very well fed, really. I mean, we were fortunate in being on the edge of the country. My father had two whacking great allotments, which my brother and I used to have to dig for victory constantly throughout the war. So we were never short of vegetables. I think the staple items of meat and fats and dairy products were very limited. And I know a constant source of worry to parents in trying to make sure that there was enough to go around. And that really, that situation really existed for quite a long time after the war, certainly well into the start of the 50s.
Do you think your health or growth was affected by lack of food?
No, I don't think so. If anything, we were probably healthier as a result of it. Certainly there was nowhere near as much fatty foods in the diet.
Any other Second World War recollections you can put down on record?
No, the only other thing which vividly stays in my memory is the build-up in the area prior to D-Day, when the whole of the south coast, of course, became one armed camp. And for 4 or 5 weeks before D-Day, two Royal Naval Commando units were encamped in our field in our road. So naturally enough, my brother and I and all the other young boys of the village very quickly made friends with the sailors in the units and spent our time admiring their weapons and watching them do their unarmed combat and all their other drills that they used to do. And what amazed us more than anything else, I think, was that they were there for this 4 or 5 weeks, and then suddenly on D-Day itself, of course, they were gone, and it was so dramatic. One minute they were there, and the next minute everything had gone. And all of us locally, I'm sure, wondered what had happened to them, because none of them returned to this area after D-Day. And so we had no knowledge until many years later of how they'd actually got on and who had survived and what their casualties had been like. And I think we were all deeply affected by it, because even as young boys we'd made quite close friends with some of the sailors in the units, who of course weren't allowed to say that they were going anywhere, and we'd at that time got used to them going off for exercises, because they were obviously practicing the landings for D-Day at various points along the coast. So as I say, that was probably the most dramatic thing that happened to me as a young boy during the war, this sudden break with something which you'd been involved in.
How would you summarise your own personal experience of the Second World War? Was it one of deprivation and unhappiness, or the reverse?
No, very much the reverse. I mean, looking back, I think most children who were fortunate, like we were, to be away from the main areas of devastation, were excited by it all. And it was, for a young boy with no worries, of course, of feeding and financing and housing, an exciting and exhilarating time.
Did you ever think that Britain might lose the war?
No, I don't think I can remember anyone ever feeling that we would be beaten. I think most people had this laid-back attitude that we always get off to a bad start, but quite convinced that in the end we'd turn it round.
Now, can you tell me about the post-war period and how you came to be in the forces yourself, please?
Yes, in 1947, the firm that I was working for, the British Powerboat Company, of course no longer had to make air sea rescue craft and motor torpedo boats for the Royal Navy, and in order to keep the factory in being, they tried to switch to making what can best be described as the first of the prefabricated houses, which were made out of two skins of plywood with a fiberglass layer in between the frames. And several were built. In fact, I understand from the Historical Society that there are two or three buildings still left which are in good state of repair and still lived in. But they never caught on. People were not prepared to spend the sort of money that you need for a house, even a prefabricated one, out of a material which has got a fairly limited life, or they thought it had. And so gradually the firm went bankrupt, and by the middle of 1947 it was fairly obvious that I was going to have to leave anyway and look for other employment. And I'd been an army cadet ever since I was 14, and I've always intended to join one of the services, and my leaving the factory also coincided with a friend of mine who was about to be called up for national service. And so the two of us decided we'd join up together, but I was a year younger than him. The only service we could get into who accepted people below the age of 17 and a half was the Royal Marines. And so we both went across to the recruiting office in Southampton and applied to sign on with the Royal Marines, and at that time the only engagement was for 12 years from the age of 18. So at the tender age of 17 I signed my life away for 13 years so as to be with my chum in the services. And it's typical of the services that the moment we finished recruit training we never saw each other again for the rest of our service.
Where did you do the recruit training?
We spent 6 months doing drill and PT at Deal in Kent, and then 2 months at the infantry training centre at Limpston, 4 weeks commando training, 4 weeks naval gunnery, and 2 weeks seamanship. And then the squad passes out as a King Squad, as it's called. When they finished all their training, the senior squad in under training becomes the King Squad of that time, and they have a ceremonial parade, and the best all-round recruit for the King Squad is given a King's Badge, which is the Royal Cipher, GVR, from the King George who instituted the award in 1918. And I had the King's Badge for my squad, so in theory I was destined to go places.
Can you describe what the training was like and how you coped with it?
Yes. The training was extremely tight discipline. The Corps in 1947 had seen, one can only describe it from the hierarchy's point of view, I think, as a watering down of the standards of discipline, drill and turnout which had existed prior to the war. They'd seen this watered down because during the war there were something like 85,000 Marines serving who'd done necessary training, of course, for the job that they had to do during the war. But that wasn't the peacetime job, which required a different approach. And so in 1947, the Corps was going right back to 1939 standards. And so the 6 months of training at Deal was really marching up and down on a parade ground and doing arms drill and squad drill day after day. And it was a shock to the system, to say the least, for a young chap. But I think it produced a good standard of servicemen afterwards. In fact, I'm sure it did.
And the commando training?
Yes. The commando training was undertaken at Bickley at that time. And really, I'm not in a position to say very much about it, because when we'd finished our infantry training, virtually all of the small arms instructors in the Royal Marines were National Service NCOs who had been enlisted for their 2 years immediately after the war. And like all big organisations, someone at the top had forgotten that if they were going to serve for 2 years, and they'd taken the whole batch of junior NCOs from these national service ranks, that they would all go at the same time. And so overnight, virtually, the Corps would be deprived of all its small arms instructors. And so when we'd finished our infantry training, the King's Badgeman and the runner-up for the King's Badge in each squad was taken out of training. The squad went on and did their commando course, and two of us were sent along with King's Badgemen and runner-ups from other squads to Browndown, which was the small arms school of the Royal Marines at Leon Solent. And we did an 8-week course there, learning how to teach small arms, which we'd only just learnt ourselves in our infantry training, of course. And then immediately we went back to Limpston, our infantry training centre, as instructors, with the unpaid acting rank of Lance Corporal. And we served there for 18 months, filling in the shortfall of instructors due to this sudden move out of the National Servicemen.
So you never really did the commando course?
No. Eventually, many years later, I was seconded to the Australian Army, because up until that time I'd served as a sea service marine. I'd been on board a ship, and then subsequently, after coming back from a ship, I joined the special boat sections, which were at that time called the small boat sections of the Royal Marines. And so right up until I'd served for 8 or 9 years, I'd never done a commando course. But then they required instructors to start off the Australian commando companies again, which had been disbanded in Australia at the end of the war. And myself and another sergeant were sent out to Sydney to act as their instructors. And so before I went, I did a very shortened version of the commando course down at Bickley, simply to acquaint myself with it. I subsequently served for 14 months in Australia, and one of my jobs was to establish the standard of commando fitness and training for the commando company there. And so in order to be able to do that, I had to do all the bits myself and establish the timings and the records and so on. And so when I left, the Australian commanding officer presented me with a green beret, which up until then I'd never been entitled to wear in the Royal Marines.
Which years were you in Australia doing that job?
1955 to 1956.
So after you'd done this job at Lymston as a small arms instructor,
yes.
Is that when you went into the small boat section?
No, I came out of the infantry training centre once they'd got more senior instructors brought back from the various commandos and trained and to replace us. And of course reverted to the rank of Marine. And then decided to join the signals branch of the Corps, and very quickly found after I'd started signals training that I really didn't like it very much. And at that time I'd met several people in the barracks who were serving with the small boat sections, and I thought, well, this is really what I want to go for. But of course, like all service organisations, you can't just turn around and tell someone that you no longer like what you're doing and you want to change. And the only way for me to leave the signals branch was to become so bad at it that they would be only too pleased to see me go. And so I kept on making mistakes with my Morse reads and my semaphore reads, and generally being a pain in the neck until I was invited to leave. But then again, typical service, I didn't go where I wanted to go. I was drafted to a ship straight away as a young Marine, which was destined for a 2.5 year commission to the East Indies Fleet. And at that time, the system on board 6-inch cruisers was that the Marine detachment would be responsible for 1/3 of the ship's guns, usually a couple of the motorboats, and the rest of the detachment would be doing watchkeeping duties, such as corporal of the gangway, cell sentry, keyboard sentry, and so on. And it was recognised that you did 3 months on one watchkeeping job, and then you had a 3 month tour on a job which was not easier, but more comfortable. It didn't require you to be on watch 4 hours at a time and then off 4 hours and so on, like a watchkeeping job did. And instead of being taken off watchkeeping at the end of 3 months, as one would expect, because I'd arrived at the ship with this rather unhappy background of trying to get my own way, I found that I was on watchkeeping for the whole time that I was on ship, moving from one watchkeeping job to another. And I learnt then very quickly that in a big organisation you can't beat the system, and really you've got to knuckle down and get on with it. And I think probably that in the end was the best thing that could have happened to me. Eventually I think I convinced the system that I was back on track, and came home early from the ship to do an NCO's course, and while I was waiting to do it, I managed to get myself into the small boat section in